Stoa is a digital campfire where we cohere in dialogue about what matters most at the knife's edge of what's happening now.
Welcome to the Stoa. I am Peter Lindbergh, the steward of the Stoa, and the Stoa is a place for us to cohere and dialogue about what matters most at the knife's edge of this very moment. And today we're going to get some culture war on with Paul Vanderclay. And for those of you who don't know, Paul is a pastor at Living Stones Christian Reformed Church in Sacramento, California. And he runs a popular YouTube channel, having conversations with the likes of Jordan Peterson, Jonathan Bigeau, and John Vervaeke. So this is going to be a standard Q&A kind of conversation at the Stoa. I think I see some new faces. So how it goes here, Paul and I will have a brief conversation. He'll share his thoughts on the title of today's talk. If you have any questions, throw them in the chat box. I'll call you to unmute yourself. If you want me to read it on your behalf, let me know, because this will eventually go on YouTube. We have about 50 people RSVP'd, but half of that is here, so we might have more people trickling in. So that being said, do I have anything else I want to say? No, I don't. So, Paul, how's it going today? You're mute. Yeah,
I'm doing well.
Cool. So I thought before we dive into the kind of like the theme of today, maybe you can kind of, for people who are just coming in, who don't know nothing about you, like, who are you? What is your maybe worldview? And what maybe some themes that have been coming up on your YouTube channel and what's at the edge of your thinking?
Okay. My name is Paul Vanderclay. I'm a minister in the Christian Reformed Church of North America, a denomination that was established by, it's basically Dutch Reformed. There are about 2/5 of the Christian Reformed churches in Canada and the rest in the United States. I have been a pastor here in Sacramento for 23 years. Before then, I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic. I, for the most part, have sort of done my job quietly in my little corner of the world. And about 3 years ago, I became acquainted with Jordan Peterson's work. And I was fascinated by his work, and I was equally fascinated by the following that he was developing. And when he started the biblical series, I thought, this is something worth jumping into. But by that point, he had about 300,000 subscribers, and it was already kind of a big thing to jump into. So I thought, well, I'll just add my two bits to the conversation on YouTube. And I hadn't really done much on YouTube, but thought I'll play with it and probably find some conversation partners. Like many who were excited about the work of Jordan Peterson, I was having difficulty finding other people who were watching dozens of hours of him. Then I wanted to talk about it with someone. So I thought, well, if I do a YouTube channel, I'll probably be able to talk with 5 or 10 other people who are interested, who somehow find my channel. But I was unprepared for what would happen, which was a lot of other people found my channel. And I had way more conversation partners than I ever had before. And so I started doing conversations with people I wanted to talk with who were talking about this. And these were just random people who would contact me and want to have a conversation. So I started posting them on YouTube because I found the conversations were starting to repeat. And then discovered that there was an appetite for those as well. So I did some commentary videos, what I pretty much today call monologue videos. It's basically my processing what John Vervaeke calls the meaning crisis. I just finished this afternoon a conversation with Cale Zeldin, who was raised Roman Catholic and just recently wrote a penetrating article about sense making. He's been listening to IDW characters. And so I've found this a good way to try to process what I think is the end of modernity. Now, modernity has been dying for 100 years already, but these things die slowly. And perhaps where I fit into this space is Jonathan Peugeot is an Eastern Orthodox icon carver. I'm a Protestant, and John Vervaeke is a non-theist. And I continue to believe that Christianity is a viable option for people who are looking to escape from the meaning crisis and find sense making. Yet, I think the church has continued to change throughout its 2,000 years and will continue to do so. The scary thing is that sometimes the church goes down dead ends, and you never quite know if you're pursuing a dead end until 50 or 100 or 200 years after you've done it. So I talk out loud on the internet, and some people listen and talk back, and that's what I do, besides being a pastor of a church.
Right. And I said beforehand that I was obviously Stoic, but secretly a Christian, not so secret. And I'm an Orthodox Christian, actually. So I got my prayer rope right here. So me and Jonathan Bigeot have a fellow company there. So I'm curious, why the Protestant path? And I think I read your bio. That was something that you fell into, you were baptized into.
I'm third generation minister in the Christian Reformed Church. So this is my tribe. This is my family. A lot of people listen to my videos and are rooting for me to change traditions, but I have no plans on it. The Protestant angle, I brought that up in my conversation recently with Jonathan and John. I'm not promoting Protestant in it, but the Protestant Reformation, I think in many ways, is both at the root of the dawning of modernity, and unresolved issues in the Protestant Reformation, I think, are driving some of the causes of its demise. And so everyone in this current crisis have things that they need to work through, usually because of their own tradition. If it's a very ancient tradition like the Orthodox, well, there's the Roman Catholics have a lot to work through right now, and Protestants do as well. In many ways, the different traditions work at different speeds. The Orthodox, a very slow speed, very ancient. Roman Catholic, a little bit faster. They're a little bit newer. Protestants are like squirrels all over the place, stowing nuts in different trees and often forgetting where they are.
And so for the title of today's talk was Being a Christian in Culture War 2.0. That's something I've written about. Peter Prokosian had a different take on it. So I'm curious if you have like any general thoughts on that, and maybe just any general thoughts, and I'll kind of have some follow-up.
I think culture wars are good places for Christians. And the reason I say that is because Christianity's birth narrative happened in the midst of a very fierce culture war. The Jewish people are an amazing group of people who have fiercely resisted assimilation, and were doing so in the midst of heavy pressure from Rome and Hellenistic culture. And into that culture war, where just about everybody hated each other, they could all, Romans and anti-Romans could agree that the world was better without Jesus, and so they killed him. And in some ways, the rise of Jordan Peterson was directly a result of the culture war, because Jordan had been making the same kind of arguments for many years, and you can find them on YouTube, but the man and the moment found each other with Jordan Peterson. And I think Jesus he's the master and he's the example because of how he lived in the midst of a culture war. The Romans just didn't quite understand him. The zealots were probably deeply frustrated with him. And the Pharisees, who should have been closest to him in that culture war, eventually had a hand in putting him to death. But after his death, resurrection, and ascension, many of those Pharisees became Christians of a sort. So I think even though Christians will complain about culture wars because they're hard on us and they're tremendously uncomfortable, I think Christianity is uniquely suited to a culture war environment because it does the one thing that culture war can't make sense of. It loves its enemies. And whenever you have a war, that's the first thing to go, because both your allies and your enemies will say, this is the one rule that must not be violated. You must maintain your tribe.
And so how do you do that in the heat of the culture war battle? And maybe how do you do that generally, and how do you do that personally?
Well, Jesus, the heart of Jesus' command is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, the neighbor goes all the way up to and includes your enemies. And in the Sermon on the Mount, which is supposed to be Jesus' quintessential distillation of his message, people to this day cannot agree on what the theme of that message is. But right in the middle of it, Jesus makes the observation that God the Father brings rain and sun upon the righteous and the unrighteous. And then Jesus says, be perfect, do like him. And so if in the midst of a culture war, you simply display weakness, which means you're just the embodiment of niceness and oh shucks, can't we all get along? That doesn't really work. It's loving someone you disagree with, and sometimes someone you disagree with greatly. Now, in this context, we immediately think of some political rival in the culture war. But for many of us, the people that we love are also the people that potentially we might hate. They might have been a bad parent. They might have been an unfaithful spouse. They might be a rebellious child. They might be a traitor to some ideological tribe that you care deeply about and are committed to. So how do you love that person and not lose yourself? And I think it's that sort of thing that we see from Jesus, because if you read the Gospels, he's no pushover. He doesn't have a problem denouncing things, whitewashed tombs. He calls some of his adversaries, and again, a lot of these adversaries are the ones closest to him in terms of beliefs. Yet, this is the same man that at his execution asks praise for the forgiveness of his executioners while his body is dripping with the mocking spittle of his enemies. That is a powerful thing, and that is an enormous challenge, which you're looking for a meaning crisis. Well, if you try to walk that road, you will find meaning.
That's a pretty cool reframe, that the culture war itself is an opportunity to practice one's Christianity.
Yeah, I think so. I look at the origin story. Take a look at the culture war that Jesus was in the midst of, and then read what he does carefully. The side that he's closest to really wants to pigeonhole him. So Jesus, engage in our culture war. When I was, raised in the Christian Reformed Church, raised in a parsonage, the son of a preacher, went to Calvin College, and Calvin College's ethos was not so much, really try to contain the covenant faithful, but when you get to college, start thinking for yourself. And so I started reading the Bible really for the first time for myself, and I was immediately frustrated by all the stories about, why are they so hung up on what he does on the Sabbath and all these purity laws? Well, if you take a look at that culture war, all of these were the kinds of symbolic virtue signals that one did to position themselves on one side of the war or the other. And you find Jesus, in some way, sometimes intentionally doing the impure thing. You read a story where he heals somebody on the Sabbath, and it's like, well, you couldn't have seen the guy the day before or the day after, or you couldn't have done it quietly in a corner. You had to do it right there in the synagogue with everybody watching just to tick them off. And, the one story where the friends of a paralytic drop him down into the middle of a crowd in a home, and he says, your sins are forgiven. He could have said, take up your mat and walk, and everybody would have said, well, that's the script. He immediately goes for the sins. And it's like, he knows exactly how to poke them but he doesn't do it in a culture war way. And he is an enigma to everyone, including his disciples, but yet for 2,000 years, we can't seem to look away. So if you want to know how to live in a culture war, look at Jesus. The only caution I'll give you is that if you do what he did, you'll probably get what he got, which is dead. So if you don't believe in the second part of the story, which is resurrection, the first part might not make a lot of sense.
Getting hung on the cross is the ultimate Christian practice. So I have a few more questions, but we've got a lot of stuff in the chat happening. Let's see here. Okay, David Jacobs, you have a question, if you can unmute yourself and ask it to Paul. David, are you here?
I guess I'll just read it. I wrote it down. So I was fascinated to come on to this talk about the culture wars, because I am been watching it very carefully for the last 4 or 5 years. And I'm wondering how you explain the vilification and the demonization of the enemy by right-wing evangelicals and the politically conservative Christian nationalists. I know I'm throwing a lot of words out there. You pick the one you like the best.
That's fine, Dave. Dave is a member of our local Sacramento meetup, so it's fun to get his question. How do I explain that? Christians aren't always very good at being Christian. And they're just not. That's been the story right from the start. You know, 1/6 of his disciples betray him. Only one of those two was restored. And when if you read the New Testament closely, you know, there was a fierce debate about what it meant to be a Christian. And if you look at, you know, you look at the story of the Apostle Paul, you look at Stephen, you know, if you thought that the adversity against Christians were bad, well, amongst Christians, it was terrible too. I'm a Protestant, and so I believe that Christians are saved by grace. Now, I know that is often read as somehow a dodge, but I, being a Christian, know that I'm often bad at it. And so I'm thankful for a doctrine that says that my Lord is patient with me, and whatever I do, whatever good I do in his name, on his behalf, is done out of gratitude. So, and I think, not to pick on people, let's say, to the right of me politically, but you know what we've seen over the last few years is those on the left know how to treat their out-group poorly too. So I think that's a human thing, and ideally, following Jesus will, in increasing measure, lead us to extend grace to an ungracious world.
Cool. Dan Feldman, you had a question.
Yes, I had a question. Doesn't the dualism inherent to patriarchal monotheistic religions such as Christianity fuel the meaning crisis itself?
If you accept the terms patriarchal, depending on how you define it, I would argue that at least the meaning crisis as presented by, let's say, John Vervaeke, and even if we take it as far back as we can, let's say to the 11th century, Christianity was still around 1100 years before then. I think a lot of the meaning crisis that we're dealing with now is a product of modernity and a product of a lot of systems that suggest that, I have hours and hours of video on this stuff, that suggest that we are not what we think we are. whether that is in a psychological frame, that there are things underneath us that are pulling the strings that our conscious self and this manifest image are unaware of, or if we look at that in an evolutionary biological frame where I think I'm acting this way, but it is all the tribalism of my ape ancestors that is actually manifesting itself out in these other ways. So I wouldn't say that you can place the meaning crisis, as we've been talking about, at least in the Vervaeke channels, to the feet of Christianity, unless you also place that, unless you also place the scientific revolution at its feet. And I would also argue that the deconstruction of the patriarchy and almost all of the progressive ideas that we've seen in the last few hundred years also find their genesis in Christianity. Because in much of human history, outgroups were simply enslaved and killed. Why does the victim of societal oppression gain status in our narratives? And I would think that Nietzsche spoke presciently about it by saying, well, it's that Christianity that somehow made everyone equal, and you have this Jesus that dies for people who think wrong. So that would be my answer to that.
Good. Can I ask a follow-up to that question, Peter?
Just one, Dan.
Okay, just one. I think the issue is I think you focused on the patriarchal part of my comment. And for me, the more prescient word there is dualism. And I, from my perspective, is that having a God be somehow separate, or, and also from my understanding, I'm not a Christian or anything for that matter. I'm probably a non-theist, perhaps, that the disconnection from nature that I think is inherent in Christianity is kind of that core of that dualistic division.
That's a great point and a great question. If you listen to Brett Weinstein, David Sloan Wilson, I think they make the compelling argument that human beings are not simply biological creatures, but fairly early on, a culture strain developed in us that you simply can't understand a human being without those two tracks, both the, let's say, the material genetic track and the culture track. I don't think humanity is going to get away from dualisms because of our two-track nature, because that culture track has become so deeply embedded and entwined in the genetic track that if you were to, I mean, science fiction plays with this sometimes, if you were to take a sperm and an egg and try to develop it completely apart from any human contact, first you couldn't do it because you'd have to find a place divorced from it. But I don't think what you would arrive at is what we would call a human being. And I think that culture track is, by virtue of it being thought-based, immaterial, logos-based, I don't think we're going to ever get away from dualisms as human beings if you buy the evolutionary biologist argument about what human beings are.
All right. I can tell Dan has another follow-up, but do you want to sneak it in, Dan? I'll give you one
more. I guess my point is that, like, for example, with Taoism, for example, there's the yin yang. There, the Taoists clearly saw poles, but they spoke of them as in dynamic, a mutual dependency between them. And I think that in much of Western civilization, and I think Christianity played a big role in this, that the mutual dependence was not emphasized. I agree that there's always going to be an up and a down and this sort of thing, just like the Taoists do, but they emphasize this dynamic balance and interplay between the two that can never be escaped. And I think in Western culture, we tend to, you know, with Descartes, we decapitate, we separate, we dissect, we vivisect. And I think that's something that makes us a bit different in that sense.
And what you're pointing to is a lot of the conversation that I've been having with John Vervaeke and Jonathan Peugeot, because, and I actually think, so one of the things that I've after watching Jordan Peterson and Sam Adams debate, I think part of what happened to the implicit definition of God was that God got bifurcated. And so our assumptions about Christianity have sort of, and I think, again, the Protestant Reformation has a lot to do with this, because with the move away from sacraments with Luther, faith became a very psychological thing and God became a very other thing. Whereas if you say, look at the angel's cry in Isaiah 6, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. That's as high as you can go. The whole earth is full of his glory. And so I think part of what we see in the Hebrew scriptures is that, ironically, Christianity develops, as many have said, somewhere between Jerusalem and Athens. But the Jerusalem side is the side that says of earth, this is our home. And so these issues have been debated broadly throughout Christianity for a very long time, and you can still find them today. I think, in fact, many conservative Christians in the West are functional Gnostics. When you hear them say things like, well, to be a Christian means going to heaven when you die, well, Christians, in terms of the idea about the intermediate state, do believe they'll be with the Lord when they die, but in Christianity, our final status is resurrected, is bodily resurrection. So it's also ironic that with a modern skepticism about the resurrection of the body, I think that sort of distorts Christianity away from the cry in Genesis 1 of God saying, of our embodied creation in the flesh, it is good, it is very good. So, but you make a great point.
I withdraw.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Limited to two follow-ups for this session. Okay, we got Laura. Laura's next.
Hi. Let's see if I can pull up my question again. In loving your enemies, how do you balance holding firm to your beliefs and remaining open to the possibility that your enemy might have a truth to offer you? And how does a Christian move past a sense of righteousness of belief when necessary? It seems like many tribes in the culture war seem to struggle with this.
I think there's a reason we all struggle with it, because it's really hard. First of all, I think with Jesus, we see he manages to do this. But one of the amazing things that we see about Jesus, and you can see it in the Old Testament as well, in Genesis 18, where Jesus seems open to the influence of others. And you would say, well, if the Son of God incarnate comes down, surely he should be talking all the time and he wouldn't need ears. But that's clearly not the portrait we see with Jesus. So I think it takes the development of wisdom. And this is one of the real contributions I see John Vervaeke making to the conversation and Peter with the Stoa as well, because I've heard these themes coming out of this conversation as well, that we must cultivate wisdom, and Christians don't have a corner on wisdom. If you read the book of Proverbs carefully in the writings in the Old Testament, you'll notice that many of the Proverbs come from non-Hebrew sources. The book of Job, which may very well be the oldest book in the Bible, many people believe, many scholars believe that the book of Job as we currently have it is an adaptation of other wisdom literature prior to that. Even the stories such as Genesis 1 and 2, I think, are in conversation with Egyptian and Babylonian creation stories as well. So if the Bible can listen to others, and if Jesus can listen to others, and if God the Father stands before Abraham, which is the older of the two, because, you know, very pious people said, no, Abraham must stand before God. But if God can stand before Abraham, and Abraham can plead the cause for Sodom, and God will listen and negotiate with him, well, we shouldn't be so full of ourselves to be above God. So, no, Christians have a hard time with this, because human beings have a hard time with this, because especially when we get angry, and culture wars tend to do that, that anger fills us with a feeling of righteousness, and then we tend to do most of our damage. So it's a great question.
Any follow-up, Laura? You're on mute.
No, that was great. Thank you.
Awesome. Aaron, you're up next.
Hey, Paul. Great to talk to you. I'm friends with Mark Hoffman down in Alameda, and we were
wonderful.
We were looking forward to having you back in March, I think it was, but it's great to finally have a chance to ask you a question. I think of platforms like the Stoa as being a kind of church. It's kind of a weird decentralized place where people meet up to sort of build community and engage in rituals and sense making. And you're engaging in this too with your online platform on YouTube. Do you see Christianity as moving more into this kind of strange online decentralized space, having kind of online churches where people come together from all over into little clusters like we're in right now? And do you see yourself as kind of being a pastor in this world right now? Do you have like an online church? Do you think of your platform as being sort of an online Christian church?
I've recently started two new efforts in my channel, and I'm calling them Living Stones Online, because so many people can't go to church physically. And so we're going to try to do what we can to continue our community online. But the second effort I call Estuary, which I think when I listened to Peter's introduction to the Stoa, this is a very estuary-like space. And what I mean by estuary is that if you have a walled garden, which in some sense the church is, and it rains in your walled garden, if you don't bless the rest of the world with your water, you're going to establish a reservoir. And so Sacramento is right at the edge of the great California Delta, and you're at the other end of it. And so I think Christianity has always been in this space. It just hasn't done it well all the time. In the book of Acts in Ephesus, Paul rented a hall. The Apostle Paul rented a hall called the Hall of Tyrannus. And the book of Acts describes him as regularly meeting there and discussing the philosophies and the ideas of his day. He also did this on Mars Hill in Athens. I think medieval monasteries did a similar thing by, you know, why do we have the monastic movement preserved the pagan writings of the ancient world? Why would monasteries do such a thing? Why didn't they not only not burn the books, but copy them? You know, so the church has done this, I think, throughout its time, but the church always has two things to deal with. And in my tradition, we call them common grace on one hand, which says God speaks through creation and he speaks through others, but also, you know, special revelation. And so the church has to somehow maintain both the understanding of an antithesis, but also the understanding of common grace. So I'm hoping that my whatever efforts I can contribute to creating an estuary-like space will, I think it makes churches better to to talk and to listen. As the old adage says, we're given one mouth and two ears. And churches sometimes major on the mouth and forget they have ears.
Thank you.
Andrew, you had a question. I copied and pasted it for you. If you can unmute yourself.
Yeah, good day, Paul and Peter. How are you going? My question was really just your thoughts on the shift, if you think there has been one, in the new atheism in the last decade or so. This is a bit of a smaller focus question than the ones we've had, but somebody like a Sam Harris and, I don't know, Peter Boghossian and people like that you mentioned from time to time on your channel. If I think back 10 years, they probably were more of an opponent, someone to contend with, but in recent times, they've sort of been on the same side, I guess. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts on, you know, what happened there, you know, what took place, and just interested in what you've got to say there.
A very astute listener of my channel that I've had a number of conversations with, he's a cardiologist up in Idaho, noted to me that you begin to hear from people often when their assumed power in society is slipping. And we've seen that from Christians for a very long time, all throughout modernity. But his observation was that in some ways, new atheism reached its peak as they began to feel the pinch of modernity receding. The irony of that recession is that new atheists are increasingly finding themselves allied with Christians who are making assertions about some fixed aspects such as human nature. I think new atheists in some ways have a more difficult time because this type of losing feels new to them. I mean, for many years, Sam Harris would go on stage and he developed quite a following because, as some of the people who listen to me have said, every time Sam Harris would sort of mock and expose Christians, you know, Christians didn't have an answer. Well, I had a conversation with James Lindsay on my channel a year or so ago, and I wasn't really aware of sort of the split of the Church of Atheism between, I would say, classical liberal atheism and atheism plus. And so that has happened. And yeah, it's produced some surprising things. One day on Twitter, I saw Peter Boghossian tweet, recommend my podcast to his following. And I thought, this is a strange turn of events where a man who writes a manual for creating atheists starts recommending my podcast. Either I've somehow lost my way as a Christian minister or the world is changing. And so I'm more than happy to have productive, honest conversations with new atheists. And obviously we have disagreement, but you know, here I think John Vervaeke is a real example of someone with whom you can have differences, but have a really productive, honest conversation. And so I, you know, again, if Christians are called to love their neighbors all the way up to and including their enemies, well, if new atheists are suddenly warming up to Christians, I've got no problem with talking with them too.
Cool. Joe, you had a question that would be a good follow-up. I copied and pasted in the chat for you. Joe, are you there?
I have a mouthful of Chipotle. Can you ask for me, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
It'd be fun listening to it, but you know, I will not, it's unchristian like to ask. Okay, so what does Paul Vanderclay make of human rights as a secular replacement for all people being made in the image of God? Holland makes the argument that it's just as faithful an idea as those found in the Bible, and I'm inclined to agree.
I think Holland is right. Nicholas Waltersdorf, who's a philosopher, was one of my professors at Calvin College, has made a similar argument for years. I think it's, I don't know where else you find respect for low status outsider human beings beyond what you find in the Imago Dei or the image of God as we find in Scripture. Now, that being said, the people of God have not always lived that way. But it is, I think anthropology has borne this out. I was reading a book about the Navajo, noting how Navajo language, just like just about every other language of the world, they had two categories, the people and everyone else, Jew and Gentile, citizen and barbarian. This is completely common to humanity. And now suddenly, and you can see it in Jesus, and you see the Apostle Paul bringing it out completely, that here you have a God over all the earth, and all the peoples of the earth belong to him, not just a particular ethnic group. So yeah, I think human rights is directly downstream from Christianity. I think because of how secularity unfolded, there was a need to place it in this imagined religion-free zone, but I think those distinctions and definitions are also breaking down as modernity recedes. So, yeah, I agree.
Cool. I think this is Manus. I copied and pasted your question in the chat if you're going to unmute yourself.
Yeah, Paul, what is the most prevalent criticism against Christianity in the culture war from your understanding? And what is your response to it in light of Christianity having a legitimacy in helping to alleviate the culture war?
I think the dominant modernist, strongest dominant modernist argument against Christianity has been the problem of suffering. The formulation of the problem of suffering or the problem of evil arose, interestingly enough, after the destruction of Lisbon, because that was right at the beginning of the modern period. It really shook the world. Before that, calamities happened. You can read it in the book of Job. There's an ancient version of the problem of evil. But after human beings began to have a vision of our capacity to manage the world in a better way than nature did, once we had the kind of technology that began to have an impact on plague, on famine, human beings began to say, hey, if we can run the world minimizing plague and famine, war we struggle with. But if we can run the world minimizing plague and famine, why do we imagine that there's a benevolent God up there managing the world? Aren't we better managers of the world than God? Nature is red in tooth and claw. We seem to understand how to save a human life, how to buffer our existence from flood and famine, and would have said plague, but this gets into the postmodern complaint, which is, well, maybe we're not quite as good at this as we thought we were. But I think that's the most powerful argument. And I very much understand when people say, I have difficulty believing in a God because there's just too much chaos and suffering in the world. And I don't imagine a good God would allow all of this to happen. I think philosophers like Alvin Plantinga have answered the question well. But pastorally, emotionally, if you're suffering, it's a powerful question.
All right. Any follow-up, Manus?
Yeah, just in terms of the response, I mean, I feel like you touched on the first part of that, but I'm not sure I connected with the second part of the question, which is, what would your response to be to it in the culture war? So if someone would say, all right, this is the problem we have with the idea of Christianity, this good God, like, look at all the suffering. Why should we listen to Christians? Like, what Christians have to say in the context of the culture war? Like, what would our response be?
I think the dominant response of Christians has to be their lives. You know, there's a great you know, George Orwell had a great response to Joseph Stalin, who was, you know, as we know now, in the 1930s, starved the Ukraine and Belarus in the name of the utopian vision he was pursuing. And well, if you want to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. And George Orwell said, "Show me the omelet." And I think that's the challenge, because the power that we have assigned to ourselves has filled us with ambition and enthusiasm, but it seems we often overreach. And so I think the best answer that the Christian church can give are the lives of its people. And again, if you go back to my first answer to David's questions, Christians often fail. And so the real command that Christianity marches under is Jesus' command at the beginning of the book of Acts. You will receive power from the Holy Spirit and you will be my witnesses. So the degree to which Christians bear witness to Jesus is usually the degree to which others find his answers compelling.
Cool. Paul, you just had a question. If you got to mute yourself.
Let me get on the right camera here. Hi, Paul. I was raised as a pastor's kid in a conservative Baptist church in a small town in Oregon. So in that context, hard right politics and religion were very intertwined. It's very hard to separate them. I was a pretty self-aware kid, but as I've become, you know, 25 years since leaving that context, become a lot more, you know, scientifically, socially, globally conscious, and have left the faith in that process. And for me, it's hard to separate those two progressions. Does that make sense so far?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what are some other frameworks that, and I assume I'm not the only one, what are other frameworks of ways to think about that, that progression of, you know, I've gone from this place of being certain of everything I know to this place of not knowing, agnosticism, if you will, but in all other areas of my life. And it's, again, it's very hard for me to psychologically separate those. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I there are a lot of people that I talk to who have stories like yours. It was interesting to me that Jordan Peterson seemed to trigger in a lot of folks with stories like yours a reconsideration of Christianity. I grew up in a home which was, you know, conservative in terms of Christian belief, you know, the resurrection, the virgin birth, the resurrection of Jesus, the second coming, all of those things, but wasn't politically conservative. So I think a lot of people, because these things were together, they kind of associated it, and it had become a whole. And so a lot of people have sort of deconstructed that and left other parts of it. So, you know, today I posted a conversation with a guy named Jesse whose story was very similar. He deconstructed. He's since found his way back. I think traditions, every tradition needs walls, but traditions that rely too much on the impenetrability of their walls, and I'm speaking about walls metaphorically here in terms of mental structures, tend to be weak when encountering other strong traditions. And I think this has happened to a lot of people. And I think as adults, we have to exercise stewardship over our beliefs and look for the truth and work through those issues and probably be equally serious about deconstructing new beliefs as old. And so, well, there's a lot of folks with stories like yours, and that's happening in the Christian church all over the place. And so I would just encourage, I'm glad you're here in the Stoa, and encourage you to continue to pursue conversations with people who are wrestling with similar things.
So if Peter, if I could have one follow-up. I think you hit on all the right issues and the things I'm dealing with. And it's really only been in the last 6 to 12 months, I'd say within the last 12 months, that my dad and I have even had, you know, transparent conversations about this. It's mostly just been the elephant in the room, which again, I know I'm not unique there. What are some, you know, again, practical ways to open up that conversation space with him when, you know, it's clear it's a major source of pain for him. And I understand that about that.
Yeah. I think kindness is important. Patience. Work hard on not being easily triggered. And in all likelihood, your father has to work on that too. In my experience, both of you probably want a restoration of your relationship. It might not be easy because he's going to have to work through some of his own beliefs. And I think people sometimes try to short circuit this, ironically, by pursuing sort of a propositional approach, which is what they've deconstructed from. Say, Dad, if you'd only give up these beliefs, well, I don't think that's necessarily true. Again, right at the heart of Christianity is a man loving and dying for his enemies. If Jesus can do that for his enemies, surely it's a Christian goal to do that for our children with whom we have disagreements and with our parents. So I'd say keep working at it. And you can't work, you can't do his work for him. So just work on your triggers. You know, when he inevitably says something that triggers you, learn to forgive. And at that point, as a Christian pastor, I'd say, well, if you're learning to forgive, well, you're listening to Jesus, because it was Jesus who said, you know, Jesus put such a high value on forgiveness. So my best wishes are for you and your father, that you can restore the relationship and potentially have some productive, meaningful conversations about why you've made the decisions that you have. And he's also made decisions to stay with his faith. And so odds are both of you can learn from each other.
All right, let's bring us home with Joe's question. Joe, if you can ask your question and unmute yourself. This is Joe Pickens.
Hi, Paul. Good to see you.
Hi, Joe.
So I was listening to, I wasn't listening to the first part of Paul's question just now because I was too busy formulating my own question, but I caught the tail end of it and it seems somewhat relevant to my question, which is, I see a necessity for Christians, many of whom are very close to me and who I care for deeply, because that was the Protestant tradition that I was brought up in. I see a necessity for them to take the plunge, so to speak, into post-modernity and to integrate modernity with post-modernity into a Christianity, if that's what they want. But there seems to be this huge dividing line within my own family and my community between those who have taken that plunge and those who have not. And I feel like I'm in this unique position and feel called in a way to reconcile those two tribes. Just if nothing else, just within my own family and my community. And I was wondering if you can speak at all to that dynamic between those two tribes and if you have any experience with that.
It's never easy. And whatever good you wish for the other side, human beings usually aren't capable of necessarily delivering on those things. So I find, again, the central admonition of Christianity to love to usually be the best pathway forward. figure out the best way to love both sides. Love has an amazing power to afford credibility to the person who is giving themselves for the other. These things take a long time, and so be patient. I also believe this work is difficult if you don't have a vivid faith in the sovereignty of God to accomplish difficult and hard things in our midst in response to our needs and requests. And so I recommend that as well. It sounds, there are some ironies in this. Generally speaking, not always, many traditionalists have a theology that affords this type of sovereignty and power given to God. People who are more progressive and contemporary, often more skeptical, don't have that resource to fall back on to give them encouragement. So much of life is learning to suffer. It really is. And I find a strong, vivid belief in God's goodness and sovereignty and presence when we ask him to be a tremendous help to bearing under heavy loads. And so if you're going to endeavor to do a difficult thing, figure out the kinds of resources you need to endure the kinds of suffering that difficult thing will require of you. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, that is helpful. Thank you. I especially liked the what you said about loving each side as best that I possibly can. And that giving a credibility to, I mean, it's just, you know, being the person that's at the center of Christianity sort of turns out to be the solution to a lot of answers.
Yeah, that's really the program. But, and it's astoundingly scalable. Can work in a public culture war, and it can work in a family fight, can work in a marriage, can work in a parent-child relationship.
Yeah. Awesome. We're reaching our time that we have today. I thought that was a really awesome session, Paul. I really, really enjoyed that. Any closing thoughts for us?
Well, I'm, you know, I've been talking about what I call estuary, and it seems like you're doing a very similar thing here in the Stoa. You're having meaningful, open-ended conversations across culture war lines. So blessed are the peacemakers. Mm-hmm. So more power to you.
Thank you, sir. I'd love to have you back on at the Stoa. And if everyone in this chat would like to continue with this conversation, you can go to the Discord. If you haven't signed up already, just go to the rules section, give it a thumbs up, and you get access to the videos, and you just jump on a video chat if people want to continue this conversation. To plug a few events, so we have Dave Snowden, the founder and the discoverer of the Kinevan framework and the chief scientist officer of Cognitive Edge. He's like the sense-making like superstar, and he's the sense-maker in residence at the Stoa for the month of September. First session is tomorrow. That's naturalizing sense making. You can check that out. And then, Paul, we have a street epistemologist coming in next week using street epistemology during Culture War 2.0.
Should be interesting.
Should be interesting. We can set up an exchange maybe between you and Anthony Magnabosco. That's Monday, September, whatever September 8 is. I don't know what that is. At 6 p.m. Eastern Time, you can RSVP there. And if you like all these activities at the Stoa, you can support us on Patreon at the link below. All right, everyone, much love. And thank you again, Paul, for coming out today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.